Hey, this is Chris from PleasureMechanics.com, and on today's episode of Speaking of Sex, we have a very special guest. We are thrilled to welcome Lee Harrington. Lee Harrington is an internationally known sex educator who focuses on the intersection of spirituality, eroticism, and kink. He is an award-winning author and just released both an updated version of his book, Shibari You Can Use, and a sequel, More Shibari You Can Use, both hands-on manuals about rope bondage. We are thrilled to share Lee's wisdom with you today. Lee, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it is my delight.
And so we know it is often a very long and winding road to becoming a full-time sex educator. So I'd love to start by hearing a little bit about how you became a sex educator.
Happily, thank you for asking. I started out in the public kink and alternative sexuality population communities, and I refer to communities because there's a story out there, I think, that there's all one alt-sex and adventurous sexuality population, and I find that there's a wide variety depending on what each individual is looking to explore.
Yes.
And I started out in those communities back in 1996. And in 98, I went to Burning Man, of all things, and there was, I was part of a group called Temple of Atonement. And while I was there, they said, hey, we're looking for some people to do some little hands-on things for new explorers who'd like to do some stuff. And I went, oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. And so I stepped up and showed some people how to do, you know, a little rope bondage cuff for tying somebody down to a bed while having sex. And I had conversations with people about where they were going in their sexuality journey. Flash forward to 2002, I'd been doing a handful of, you know, little things here and there. And I ended up moving to being a full-time adult film model. And while I was doing that, people were like, oh, you do all this, you know, stuff, right? I was doing everything from rope bondage to, you know, tantric connection, breathing kind of work, to hitting people only in the ways that they wanted to be, and everything in between, anal sex, all of those kinds of spicy things. And people were saying, oh, well, while you're here doing this porn video, can you also do a how-to video? Can you also show us what you're doing? And it ended up being this layering on, because I'd now be, say, in New York City doing a porn production, and I'd be there the same time as a sexuality conference. And they'd say, hey, you're going to be in town. While you're here, can you also teach for us? And that happened in San Francisco and New York and Los Angeles and DC, because I was in those places for the porn industry. And in 2004, I ended up coming up with this clever idea of doing a book, because people were saying, oh, you do this really fun stuff and you have a very playful way to communicate it. I used to be a summer camp counselor, and of all things, right? At the end of the day, teenagers and adults aren't that different when it comes to wanting to have adventure. It was a fun idea. Basically, I sat down to come up with it, and the book came out in 2006, which is the one that you referenced, Shibari You Can Use. And by 2008, I made a decision to set all of the adult work aside and move full-time into doing sexuality education. And my work ranges from book writing, obviously, to and the populations I've been serving as a community insider, but also doing a lot of university guest lecturing and traveling around talking with people of all stripes about finding their own erotic authenticity. And that it includes not just having grown up in the trenches as a sexuality educator, learning by being the person who was doing those things, but also getting involved with ASECT, the American Association for Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, and other such groups, doing various trainings and learning how to be a better educator. Because it's not just about what you know, but knowing how to get it out of your head and into someone else's.
Indeed. And you just mentioned, and on your website, you call yourself an erotic authenticity educator. What does erotic authenticity mean to you, and why do you think it's important to emphasize this quality?
I believe that there's this story that happens as individuals growing up in culture, whatever your culture might be, which is those things you should do. What should sex look like? What should a relationship look like? And we end up following what culture tells us to do, or in the case of those of us growing up, especially in the United States of America, which was my journey, that for me, I was watching all of this media that said that, oh, as, you know, as an American, girls are going to either settle down and be nice farm girls who have one husband and are chaste except for those situations where they have sex in the dark in missionary style position, or you're a slut. And there was slut shaming and a lot of taboo around it. And on the other side, for men, there was, you know, oh, you've got to go out and be a jock and show you're claiming and you're conquering. And I found that really disheartening growing up because I didn't look like that. That if I was having sex with multiple people, well, clearly I was a slut or a player. And for me, as I came involved with people who, in my teens, I came involved with people before getting in the kink community who basically said, oh, well, if you're not into that, don't do it. Or if you're into that one thing, why don't you do it? And I really started looking at, well, why was I doing it? Why did I feel pressured to be involved in these various acts or activities or connections? And so from what it ended up being is this slow unraveling, you know, over the next 20 plus years of, oh, we have these stories, and what I want to be on this planet is an authentic individual. I want to walk my walk, not just talk my talk or carry these fantasies in my head, including such things as, you know, if someone is drawn to being asexual and not having any sexual connections, why don't people have the right to do that without being told they're boring or they're clearly not following, you know, well, clearly if you're really going to be happy, you have to get married. Well, why? If you really want to get married, go you. But if what you're drawn to is being, you know, a bachelor for the rest of your life, who says you can't do that as long as you're being authentic to you and not harming anyone? Mm-hmm. So it's about relationships. It's about what we do with our body. And I know people who, once they have embraced that authenticity, have had a weight lifted off of their shoulders. Sometimes it can be scary, though, in the face of culture, because there is that should. And if somebody says, you know what I really want to do? I want my lover to spank me. Oof. In some cases, that's a little edgy. For other people, it's like, well, yeah, everybody likes a little bit of hanky-panky. So to me, that's about erotic authenticity. And it's important because if we are walking in this world, following those shoulds, we end up oftentimes wondering what could have been. And I meet people who have regret around those things of why didn't I? I don't think that's fair to the heart, though. Because if you didn't pursue it, you just didn't pursue it. You were doing what was right for you in that moment. And that's okay too.
Yes. Beautiful. And we at Pleasure Mechanics focus on sex and sexual pleasure, but we often remind one another in our community that what happens within our sexuality happens in our whole lives. And we often find that when people have these breakthroughs in their sexuality, they have breakthroughs where they get in touch with their purpose, they get in touch with who they are and who they are meant to be in this world. And so these parts of our lives can inform one another.
Oh, absolutely. I concur hands down. And it's not necessarily just about, because I have people go like, oh, so if you have the kinky sex you want to, or if you enjoy having sensual massage with your partner on a regular basis, suddenly you're going to unfold a spiritual awakening. Well, what about something as simple as going, oh, well, if I have the chance to get, you know, to tie up my lover in a tight little bundle before rolling them on their side and touching them all over their flesh and having their goosebumps rise up. Well, if I can do that, who says I can't go and put in that job application for that thing I didn't think I could do? Because I've gone over one thing that I was scared about admitting and I succeeded. People can build a sense of self-empowerment through their sexual explorations.
Right. And it's not even about what you're doing, about how you're doing it and how you're connecting with your partners and the presence you're bringing to it. And that's what I so appreciate about your work, is you focus not only on the skills, but on the heartfulness and on the mindfulness it requires to have these skills translate into an incredible experience.
Thank you. It was actually really important to me when I wrote the sequel, More Shibari, which is called More Shibari You Can Use, Passionate Rope Bondage and Intimate Connection. That intimate connection to me was so important. And in each of the chapters, I decided to have an exercise at the very end about those connection techniques. So in chapter one, for example, you've learned in chapter one how to, or chapter two, technically, chapter one is all that stuff about taking care of your rope and understanding communication and consent that are incredibly important if you're going to have everybody be on the same page before exploring anything. You know, why are we all doing this? But in chapter two, we learn about, you know, everybody who's reading learns about how to tie somebody's hands together and how to tie somebody down to a bed, those kinds of techniques. And in the exercise, I have people tie their lover's hands together and then raise the hands up over the head while looking them in the eye and watching for facial responses, and then pulling that rope up between the legs and pulling their lover close while putting a hand on their heart or a hand on their belly right at their solar plexus, or a hand right above the groin, and feeling that heartbeat, feeling those butterflies in the stomach, feeling the heat down below, and becoming really present with their partner. Because I think sometimes we get so wrapped up in the how of a sex, right? Like if we're having oral sex with somebody, do I lick up, lick down, lick up, lick down, side, side, like that whole alphabet thing that people talk about? Right. You know, like, oh, my partner likes it when I do things on the left side of their clitoris. Oh, my partner likes it if I use a little of my hands on the base. Well, the technology is good. Knowing how to program the computer is useful. But what about actually breathing in time with your lover? Right. What about being in the here and now with them? What about looking them in the eye and showing them that you see them as a human, not just a vending machine?
Right.
You know, you're not just putting in quarters and getting out an orgasm. You're with a human being that you cherish, even if just for that moment.
Right. Let's take a step back for a second, because a lot of our listeners might not understand the term shibari.
Absolutely.
So what does the word shibari mean, and how does it situate within the bigger field of bondage?
So bondage is a big category that means to restrain or decorate using various materials, and to bind, right? It breaks down in that way. Shibari is a term out of Japan originally that means to bind, right? It's the same concept. And what happened in Japan, historically speaking, right, if we go back to the Tokugawa period, was that things like handcuffs and shackles and iron maidens and whatnot that we have in Western history didn't exist because metal was incredibly rare and expensive.
Mm.
And so wasting it on a giant metal cage wasn't very likely. Therefore, they ended up developing a system that has in martial arts now been referred to as hojo-jitsu, which was to restrain someone with a piece of rope. Fast, efficient, and that notion of using rope to restrain became titillating in the theater, right, of the time. Just like if we look back at Shakespearean dramas and we see somebody stretched out on the rack, it captures our imagination, we as the viewer. And imagine this again, if we look at Shakespearean era, imagine it in the 1600s and 1700s and 1800s, that style of drama, and you see somebody on stage, oh, we're so excited about it. And if we look back at our own Western history, we've got the girls in a set of handcuffs running away from the cops in the 1800s in a print art, and the number of people who were probably at home being like, oh, that's hot. It's pretty high. And so what was happening in Japan is the same thing was happening with people being restrained in rope. By the time we get to the 1920s, people in photography clubs in Japan there have been archives that have been found of people using early photography, capturing images of women in kimono with rope wrapped around them, with their hair slightly tousled out of place, looking disheveled and, because of that concept, a little bit naughty. And it became a turn-on. It was a tool for turn-on. We flash forward to where I came into all, you know, like that develops over time, just like Western styles of bondage developed over time to being something that turned people on, that wasn't just something that is used in the world at large, but was something that people were doing in their bedroom or enjoying in magazines. And I came into the public kink communities in the mid-90s, and we were getting these magazines out of Japan that had these hot pictures of girls tied up in rope, mostly girls, the occasional guy being tied up by a female dominatrix. And we were looking at these pictures and going, oh, this is a really cool aesthetic. This is really beautiful. Because a lot of Western style rope bondage is what you expect in Cowboys and Indians films and damsel in distress movies, right? It's ropes wrapped, really, you know, in a really messy way around the body and a girl tied down to the trains. Like that kind of concept in the Western media. But here these pictures were of girls with ropes below their chest and above their chest with intricate knotwork on the side, lifted into different positions and their legs pulled up in more ornate and beautiful ways. And we here in the States went, oh, that's cool. How can we capture that? How do we do that? And we started reverse engineering it. In the communities that I was in, mostly up in the Northwest United States, in the Seattle and Portland area, a little bit in BC. And nowadays, when we look at what's actually happening in Japan, the term that gets used in Japan a lot nowadays is kinbaku, right? Which is to tie rather than to bind. And because it's not just about the binding, it's also about the connection. There's actually a term called nawaza, which literally means to connect using a piece of rope, mostly in floor tying, right? Doing something on the floor or on the bed so that you're present with your partner, not just doing the techniques of it. So there's an entire school that is just about that. Wow. There are schools of kinbaku that have been passed down literally for generations, where one person trained another person, And there are other people who see hot photos and come up with their entire own style. The reason I call my book Shibari Yukizu's is that it's based out of the fact that in the mid-90s, I was being turned on by Japanese erotic images of really beautiful people tied up in really clean and elegant ways, and then having a piece of their hair pulled out so it's not quite perfect, and a shoulder of a kimono pulled, you know, and exposed just a little bit, or in the more, you know, BDSM and fetish ways, having their fishnets torn open at the crotch to make it not quite perfect anymore and to, you know, make the person a little embarrassed. So I used the term shibari you can use because I was expressing a inspired by Japanese aesthetic rope bondage. And that's what I end up explaining in the introduction, is that this is not necessarily classical kenbaku. There are pieces out of it that I cover in my work and that I have learned since then that are more classical. But what happens is that for me, and the reason I worked with the notion of shibari, is that sometimes people get overwhelmed by going and learning these formal historical forms and going through and practicing the forms over and over and learning a specific style. I would rather have people at home learning a couple of fun techniques and going and playing tonight without feeling scared. Without feeling overwhelmed, because sometimes when we wrap it in a little bit too much mystery, at least for myself, it might be hot to go, oh, I want to go and learn those really more advanced concepts. I want to go and learn under that style. It's hot to me, and I like that kind of advanced study. But for myself, there are times where I'm just like, can you just teach me how to use it today?
Right.
Can we just have fun right now? And so that's what I was aiming for in my project, was to do something, because I was doing a lot of lecturing at colleges at the time. Like, I was doing like fetish balls, where, you know, college kids would pay to, you know, bring in a goth band and and everybody dresses up in black PVC and dances around doing a little bit of, you know what I mean? Like that level of naughty. And I would be, you know, paid to show up on stage and do a little bit of naughty. And I'd have these college kids be like, how do I do that right now? And I'm like, here's a wrist cuff. Now go home and have fun.
Right. And when our audience asks us about bondage, we do often recommend that they start with cuffs because they're easy to get on, easy to get off. They're a little bit safer. But a lot of people do fantasize about rope bondage specifically and yet are reluctant to try. So what do you think some of the common fears and misconceptions are that hold people back from incorporating rope specifically?
The first one I hear is it takes too long.
Yes.
You know, like... And there are some ties, I'm going to be completely honest out there. Like, there is a tie called takarakote, which is where the hands are behind the back, the arms are straight at the side, the hands are behind the back, the shoulders are straight at the side, and it looks like a box. The upper body is a box. And you'll see this in a lot of modern Japanese or Japanese-inspired pornography, is this pose. And there's one variation of it that I think has 72 steps. And I'm like, wow, that's impressive. And that takes time and energy and focus. But there are some techniques, like the one that I mentioned, what I call the Texas handcuffs, where it's literally... It's what is it? Twist, turn, overlap, pull, slide on your partner, pull shut. Done. Once I've gotten practicing, I can do the entire tie in about 45 seconds. Usually like less if I'm not feeling nervous. Because sometimes I get nervous too if I'm, you know, with somebody that's really hot and we're really into it. It's like, oh my gosh, am I going to do it right? Like, because here I am, an erotic explorer, and I still have those moments.
Yes.
But it takes too long is a very common story. But something as simple as, you know, learning a Texas handcuff and tying your lover into it, tying their hands above the head and going for it, can be quick and efficient. The second one I hear is that it's really hard. It's really complex. And again, if you're going for a 72-step thing, yeah, it can be pretty complex. But if you are, say, doing a chest harness on someone, which is exactly what it sounds like, it's a harness on the chest, it's, you know, you pull the rope through the middle of the rope around someone's torso, you go the other direction and you go back and forth a couple of times, you tie off, you add shoulder straps, and you're done.
Yeah.
It like when you see the finished images, they can look scary. But I joke in some of my classes that really to do all of the rope bondage I do, it takes 2.5 knots.
Right.
It takes what's called a lark's head. You take the long end and you pull it through the middle of the rope and have it tightened down. That's a lark's head. The next one is an overhand knot, which looks like a number 4 or the letter P, and then you pull it on through. It's a, what some people call a stopper knot. And then the last one is a square knot. That's an 80% of the knots that I do in my daily rope bondage. So it looks complicated because you're seeing all of these layers. But once you break it down, it's not that scary. And the third one that I hear, the third and last one that I hear the most often is that I'm scared I'm going to hurt somebody.
Yes.
That one's not an unreasonable fear.
Hmm.
Because there's a couple different major concerns. There's circulation, right? Are my partner's hands going to go cold? Are they going to get that tingly hand thing? If somebody starts having circulation problems, let's say I have somebody tied with their hands overhead, you know, because that could be pretty hot, right? Tie somebody's hands to a sturdy overhead point. Note the word I said sturdy, not a window draping pole,
right?
Not, or your closet pole. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. Because tying somebody to a closet pole, if you have anything up above on those shelves, if somebody pulls on it really hard, you're dropping all those boxes on their head.
Don't do that.
Not sexy, right? Just rude, potentially damaging and rude. Right? If you tie somebody's hands to something really sturdy, that wriggling, that writhing, putting a blindfold over their eyes and stroking them up and down their body when they don't know which side you're coming from, yum, mm-hmm. Right? That can be super yummy, but people's hands can go cold. And so there are some people who go, oh, I'm scared of that. And so I just tell people who are being tied up, if your hands are going cold, it's an opportunity for your partner to do something new. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody tells me, my hands are going cold, can we move them? I look at my partner and go, oh, I have quite the idea for you. I have a wicked concept. And I'll pull their hands down. And without untying their hands, I'll then lay them down on the ground, hold that rope down in hand, while then starting to play with their lower half of their body and starting to do a little bit of genital padding or a little bit of hand play of different sorts, or pull out a great vibrator. Mm-hmm. It's a chance. The next one is the other health concerns I worry about are nerve pain. If you're getting tied up and you feel a sharp pain of any sort, you need to tell your partner immediately, because that can, if you don't take care of that, that can cause harm to your body, right? Nerve damage, you know, circulation most of the time returns pretty quickly. Nerve damage can take a long time to recover. And I'm talking months. And so I tell people, if you feel a stabbing pain, if you lose circulation, what feels like circulation or sensation really fast, if your hand starts dropping, anything like that, I tell my partner really quickly. And there's a difference between telling your lover, my hand is starting to have problems, could you change it? As compared to, what the hell did you do? My hand's gone cold.
Right.
Number two makes your partner kind of scared to listen. Number one feels like you're collaborative. And so for me, checking in both directions helps take care of that concern of I'm going to hurt my partner. The third one is, of course, positional, right? If I twist my partner the wrong way, what if their head falls on the ground? And the reality for me about that is, if in doubt, play on a bed.
Right.
Right? If they fall, they're going to fall a total of a foot.
Right.
And I think these things are important to keep in mind. I think it makes you really responsible. And to me, responsible is sexy. Okay. I think responsible is incredibly sexy in any sort of sex play. To me, if I have somebody who says, hey, I brought condoms and dental dams, let's play, it tells me they're responsible and they're thinking about my body and safety. I find that hot.
Definitely. And it seems like the techniques and learning together is an opportunity for more mindfulness and awareness in general. And that's going to improve everything in your relationship.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Actually, one of the exercises in book two is all about doing mindfulness. Like it is classical mindfulness techniques applied to rope bondage. Because for me, that idea of becoming more present, aware, being in the moment and mindful of what's happening here instead of following those stories that we talked about earlier, doing that makes everything in our life more excellent. And why wouldn't we want to explore a more excellent life through our sexuality?
We all do. And in your book, you talk about some of the reasons people enjoy bondage, and they go far beyond the most common ideas of bondage being all about power and control. Some of the reasons you list include enjoying the restraint, using bondage as a ritual or meditation, using it for decoration and art to celebrate the body, and then the sensuality of the ropes themselves. Can you talk about this whole range of different forms of intimacy that are amplified with rope bondage and the different erotic energies you can explore with it?
Happily. I've been a spiritual explorer for most of my life as well. And I started combining the two and found that when I had tied my ankles together while I was sitting in lotus position, it allowed me to kind of relax my legs into the rope. Hmm. Instead of sitting there and fidgeting and having to worry about my legs. And I was able to just be more present in the moment doing meditation. And I've had people laugh at me until I started looking into some practices with yoga where you're specifically using straps to pull yourself into different poses and maintain them. And I went, hey, okay.
Right.
So I know I came up with this on my own, but there's clearly something going on here. People have been doing this. I do a thing in one of my, I do work in the rest of, in other parts of my life as what I refer to as being a spirit worker. Some people refer to it as shamanism, but as I have not been classically trained as a shaman, I prefer not to use that language. And as somebody who works with energetic concepts and working with those kinds of astral planes and energy, and feel free to translate accordingly if that is not your personal path, feel free to refer to it as going into our own internal journey to be able to find personal truths to bring back to the world at large. Fantastic. But one of the tools I started using was what I referred to as neliomancy, where nelio being nothingness. And I would have someone bind me head to toe and then blindfold me and then put ear coverings on me so that the world was blocked out on every level. And I went into an altered state of consciousness through being taken on a bodily journey of nothingness and or, depending on how I thought of it, complete encapsulation into the womb or into a cocoon. And this allowed me to go somewhere else. One of the things that gets played around a lot with bondage is that notion of an altered state of consciousness. People sometimes refer to it as a subspace, a submissive space, the place where a submissive or person who is submitting their will goes into some energetic space that is more receptive and open and feels floaty. That happens in rote bondage too, not just for the person, or can happen for some people, not just for the person being bound of going into some form of altered state of consciousness, but sometimes for the rigor, the person who is doing the binding as well. I've had times where I've had like world chant music going in the background, like just that slow, steady, rhythmic, drumming chant, and tying perfectly in time with that. And it became a walking meditation. It became my arms moving in time with music, moving in time with my partner's breath. And I've stepped out of the world of classic being, and I went into a place where time dilated. That when I looked up and thought that only half an hour had gone by, I had been doing rigging for 4 hours and moved my partner through an entire ballet of rope experience because I was in this place of an energetic trance. So that can be a place of it. And I've also done work. I have a photograph on my photography site that I had a pair sitting in Yab Yum, which is a tantra position where the gentleman had his legs folded underneath him. And she, his female play partner, then sat on top of him with her legs wrapped around his body, and they were eye gazing. And I bound their bodies together, and they were able to have their heart match their heart and feel each other's heartbeat in the rope, breathing in time with one another, eyes locked with one another, holding each other's heart. And it was truly beautiful to behold.
Yeah, these are such different images than the classic, I'm going to tie you to the bed and spank you and fuck you, which of course has its place and can be fun. But what I really love about the way you talk about bondage is it really broadens it, and it acknowledges the vulnerability of being tied up, but also the power and beauty of that, and how bondage can be done in a way that really honors the body or degrades it, depending on your preference at the moment. But that honoring with the rope and the decoration and the use of bondage to highlight the beauty of the body and make someone feel like a beautiful object that's being adored and decorated. You know, so many people, I think, crave those experiences of being really seen and honored. And this is such a refreshing idea for a lot of people to use rope to do that. And your book really takes people step by step in how to do that in a safe way. I love in your book, you say, blindfold your lover and with this book lying next to them, get rope on them for the first time. Such a clear invitation. Like, put a blindfold so they don't know that you're learning.
That's exactly it. I actually had a fan of mine who wrote me, and what they said they did, and I'm like, that's brilliant, is that they went to a photocopy place, had the binding cut off their book, and they put in a spiral-bound book end.
Yeah.
And that way they literally could flip it open, and their partner didn't have to even hear the pages turning. Mm. And I'm like, that's incredibly clever. I love it. And it's amazing. I'm actually convinced that if you only get one tool in your exploration of various things that are considered kinky, a blindfold goes a long way. It's not for everyone, because I know some people who want to be able to look in someone's eyes, and without that visual contact, they don't feel as safe. and they don't feel as loved. So it's important to check in with someone first, or explore and find out, oh, we put on a blindfold. We did one play encounter or scene, depending on what language you use. We did one play encounter, and you know what? It wasn't as hot as when we were catching each other's eye. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to catching each other's eye. I also like with these ideas of playing around with opening concepts of rope, is that if you don't know whether you want to be bound or whether you want to bind someone, having a pair of people, having one person put a rope harness on the other and a pair of wrist cuffs and playing around a little bit, do that for half the evening and then trade sides. And then the next day, debrief about what you loved about both of them and which ones you thought were more engaging and why. Because I think everyone is going to have some opinion on it. And again, note the difference between sharing this piece was really hot, this is what I liked, or this is the piece that I didn't find as engaging, and here's why, is different than, remember when you tied me up? You didn't get any of it right. You hurt my shoulder. You clearly don't know what you're doing. I clearly do. I don't, you know, like that kind of stuff. It can be damaging to a relationship. So I encourage people to think about the love of their language too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like we could go on, and maybe we'll have to do a part two at some point. I've been reading Sacred Kink, and there's just so much in there to share.
Oh, I loved / hated writing that book. Yeah. 4 years of my life. Ugh. Wow. For those who don't know about it, the book is called Sacred Kink, The Eightfold Paths of BDSM and Beyond. And I go through 8 different major routes to altered states of consciousness and look at it through a historical lens, as well as a sexual, sensual, and kink lens, and apply the historical modern models to personal application and stuff. So yeah, 4 years of my life. It was good, but wow.
Well, I feel like we all have so much to learn from you and with you as you devote your life to thinking and experiencing spiritual sexuality and sacred kink. Where can our listeners find you online to learn more from you?
My website is passionandsoul.com. And you can get to all of my books by just clicking the books button. I try to make it pretty easy, the author button. And so that's a great way to find me. I am easily stalkable on the internet. If you type in passion and soul anywhere, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm on pretty much every media I can find under that username. And also, if you go to, I have my own podcast as well, which would be great to have you come over to at some point, planting a little seed. But my podcast is the Passion and Soul Podcast. And I use those words because I'm a big believer that those are the two really important things that get us both going, whether it's a passion for our career or a passion for a partner or a passion for our family. And soul is our own authentic self.
Thank you so much for sharing some of your wisdom with us. And everyone can get your books, Shibari You Can Use and More Shibari You Can Use. And we will link that up on the show notes page over at pleasuremechanics.com.
Thank you for having me on. It was such a delight.
Thank you. The pleasure is all ours.